Thanks, Darren. Thanks to Katya for picking me up at the airport today and giving me a tour of the city. And thanks to the people here at the Atwater Library. In my day job, I'm a librarian, so I just love libraries. And it's always nice to come into one I haven't been in before. And this is a really nice room. I wish we had a room like this in our library. Can you hear me at the back? Yeah? It's also really nice to be standing here in front of a whole bunch of unfamiliar faces, because St. John's is a very small community. It's very supportive of poetry, but you tend to see the same faces over and over again. So it's nice to read different ones. It also gives me the chance to dip back into the catalogue and read a few older ones. So I'm going to begin with a poem from my first book. This is a poem called The Heart. And when I was a child growing up in the west of Ireland, we had a German shepherd, and this dog had a great appetite, and we mostly fed him with beef hearts, which is, you know, the heart from a bullock. Most people didn't eat these in Ireland, so they were quite cheap to buy, and it's just a great big hunk of meat. Usually you could get them at the butcher, but on this occasionally you'd go down and he'd say, well, I don't have one right now, but I'm killing this afternoon, so you can send one of the boys down to the slaughterhouse and they can pick it up. So I was about 8 or 9, we went down one day and this scenario unfolded, and for a change my mother looked at me and said, well, why don't you go down and pick it up? Now the farm was quite close to my house, and it had a little slaughterhouse behind the farm where they butchered their own beasts, and this is the story told in fragments of that particular journey on that particular day. It's called The Heart. Many good angels helped me on my journey. My mother watching from the garden gate, her dress like liquid poured into a cup. The butcher's voice, come down at 3, that's if your man will let you. Come down at 3 o'clock, I'll have one then. Black cattle grazing the side of the hill, their muzzy grazers' mouths, their lips that pluck like fingers, picking lint from tablecloths. The glitter flip of wavelets on the lake, like a smashed up centerpiece decanter. The gravel crunching underneath my boots, the echo of my footsteps in the yard, the lifting off of birds about the eaves. Thoughts of Shep, her prowling like a point of etiquette. The hay shed's sudden buffeting swirl that smelled of stalk and yellow corn and hay, the ripped out circuitry of summer days. The goose that waddles right across my path, so near it almost bumps against my boots. A telegram for Pat, I hear it say. Coming back when I've been borne away by smells of stalk and yellow corn and hay, by thoughts of hay barn lofts and loose chiffon. Palms that screech along a wax-top desk, the sound that human skin would make caressed if every pore contained a vocal cord. The apparition of pigs within the piggery, their little eyes so worldly wise and quick, eyes that find in me some deficit. The cat that bangs into a mirrored door and shows me all I know of nonchalance. The moment when I stop to check my watch, a hard-shelled fly goes ping against my cheek. That moment when the sunshine reappears to set ablaze the holding pens ahead. The sound of flies, their agitating wings, like Latin whispers from a congregation. Black-faced sheep who wait with tongues stuck out as children for a wafer of communion. The butcher standing by the hoof-scarred door, his shirt sleeves rolled, his brow all slick with sweat. The butcher dressed in rubber, head to toe, fresh from the field, the dragon slain, the quest revealed as something other than expected. The carcass skinned and steaming on the floor, the deadbolt gun behind it on a hook. The butcher reaching back around the door, the heart a six-pack held in one flexed hand, his fingers piping arteries and veins, his head on tilt as if to catch a tune. The heart above my open plastic bag, its queer inverted mountain shape, its slender oxblood tip and fatty snow around the base, its sullen weight. And to jump ahead a few years to Mole, which came out in 2005, and read a poem called The Snows. which is really one of my dictionary poems. It really came out of looking at the entry for snow in the OED, in the longer version, and looking at all the different kinds of usages and just playing around with those. It also came, it's partly based on the memory of a particularly hard winter we had in Newfoundland, where we broke every record we had for snow. The snows. Snow in summer and snow on the mountain, snowberry, milkweed, and dandelion seeds. All might have been read as foreshadowing this glare, this midwinter snow blink, which renders my neighbor's dog a snow bear. My neighbor, who was from the snow belt and who for years was the only man on our block with a snowblower. Prescient now seem his snow plans in this winter of 10x snowfall. A giant 60 feet tall, he reaches and fills his arms with billowing snow. Snow like sugar hardened from damp. Snow that is like the fine ashes of summer foliage. Snow that groans under boots like boards. Snow that squeaks like a barman's towel. Snow like a horse eating whole pears. All these he gathers up and fashions loosely into a bale. He underarms up the garden where it explodes into rockfall and powder. As a man, some find him snow cold, while his wife, slightly crushed, is a snow queen, a cone tinted with sweet red syrup. Dealing with her is a snow course, where at first one walks with the stiff splinted legs of the snow crab, but soon there develops a snowcraft, a feint and thrust to her snow creep, her devil and snowdrift. It's a kind of addiction, this banter. My nostrils bell for my snow queen. I have become a snow dropper, snow dropping at will from her washing line, her snow-white panties, for which I've become a snow finch, a flea, a snowfleck, a fly, a snow gnat, a snow goose for her snow grain and grass, a snow grouse for her snow gum and snow hole, a snow leopard crossing the snow line and snowpack for snow lily, snow pea, a great snowy owl, a snow petrel, a snow wolf prowling the snow lip, hunting the snow melt for snow mice, juncos, snow vole, and partridge. It's always a challenge to get through that litany. I think it's one of the reasons I like reading that poem. This is a poem called The Old Neighborhood, which is really a series of puns. I like puns, and I keep notebooks with puns in them, and every now and again I just try and string a bunch of them together and see what happens. So there's a couple of things in this. I don't know if any of you saw the film Marathon Man years ago with Dustin Hoffman and Laurence Olivier. And Laurence Olivier played Dr. Mengele, the famous Nazi doctor. And there's a scene in the movie where he goes to New York to try and sell some diamonds. And an old Jewish woman spots him in the diamond district and starts pointing across the road at him and calling him Der Weibe Engel, which, as far as I understand, means the white angel. There's also a reference to hurling in this, which is an Irish game, not the activity practiced by undergraduates on Friday night. And there's also reference to camogie, which is another game played with a stick. The old neighborhood. It was never great, even back in the day. Here Kumquat May had her episode. Jack Hughes, she wailed at a white-haired man, Der Weibe Engel, whose eyes behind tinted lenses flicked like an analog needle. Then he was gone. Some say she was his other woman. Some say her beef was with Guinness, that black door marked with a toucan, more than it was with him or his missus, Camogie Queen, and once runner-up at the Rose of Tralee. Hurley Mary, now best known as the Mother of Gord, that poet's poet of the common man, whose particular brand of strum and dang can still be heard from time to time, the famous twang of that broken string of There's a Love Knot in My Laureate. But things are better today, much better. Streets that once burned like phosphorus are now prosperous, signs everywhere. Spa wholesaler, Martin Luther King, Jumanji, French all kosher safari. Prosperous maybe, but still a bit shady. Note the camel coat crew cuts in suits, flipping through on sale racks of thobes, while a diva in burqa winks knowingly at a man sipping tea in Mahatma Grandi's. Goland shites the lot of them, says Lloyd E. Dahl, the oldest retailer on the block. But the old have a way of forgetting just how bad it was back in the day, with the brothers Quixote, Don and Wiley, two hard men, no soft centaurs these, running a little behind from the Dalai Lama, selling it to all intents and purposes, but strictly medicinal, the whole front innocent as chasing rabbits with a hoe. Innocence thrives where we begin. My old self follows me around like an idiot suivant who knows only one thing in this world and how that thing ran true and still runs true today, a radical naivete. O little turd, who made thee? Take this couple, 20-somethings turned 30, who have traded in their designer dogs for an all-terrain stroller. Hi, Digger, squawks their 2-year-old at an idling truck, a cement mixer, while twirling a bead with chubby fingers. His parents gape at him in astonishment, and I gape in astonishment as well, when behind them, exiting the gap, a dwarf in a 3-piece pinstripe Armani barks like some kind of small arms dealer into the beak of a throwaway phone. This is my new book. Just saw it for the first time today. Isn't it pretty? I'm going to read 2 poems from this and then I'll call it quits. The first one is called History of the Lombards, and it's a poem in 3 parts, and it's dedicated to somebody you probably know, Carmen Starnino. The Lombards were a Germanic people who in the 7th century moved down from Northern Europe and pillaging and killing everything in their path, supposedly, and ended up forming a kingdom in Northern Italy, which was dominant in the region until they were defeated in the 8th or 9th century by the Franks under Charlemagne. A History of the Lombards. 1. Because I no longer trust my eyes, I can tell you about the Lombards, who not only hauled their huts on sleds from the frozen reindeer lands, but also brought the frontier with them, presenting it to their enemies, the settled down folk, the soft and comfortable, the easily fooled. The further south the Lombards went, the more gullible the people. How else to explain the deception carried out by the Lombard women, who in beards woven from their tresses stood disguised as men among their men, a shadow army flickering between campfires? Ahead of the Lombard advance ran rumors of dog-headed soldiers who ate nothing but blood-soaked oats and would, if kept from battle, gut themselves so as to gorge on their own gore. In this way, whole armies weakened and were broken before the fighting even began. 2. The Lombard king, by this time half blind, halted one evening his piebald mare so she could drink her fill from a fish pond. But what he saw there made him stare for some time, made him twirl his birch lance and with its butt end stir the waters. What he saw filled his heart not with fear, but admiration and gratitude for a life that could still move him to wonder. Long he squinted into the brackish, leaf-flecked pool where squirmed 7 infants, his attention undisturbed by the laughs and advances of the prostitute who had just that morning delivered them. The spell broken only when a fat fist gripped the ladling spear and the old king, seized and shaking, raised from the fish pond a banner, his streaming, wriggling, blue-eyed successor. 3. The day the Lombards faced the Heroli, the sky divided. Above the Lombards it brooded, while above their enemy it remained blue. Both camps read this as an omen. It was clear to all there would be a decisive victory. Dear reader, can you tell me which side won? I guessed from that blue sky the Heroli, but I was wrong. Who knew that a spell brewed in the Lombards' cloud boil? Soon thunderhead hammers fell on their enemy, so confusing them, they mistook the green flax fields at their backs as pools fit for swimming, and reaching out arms and kicking out legs, tried to breaststroke. This was how the Lombards found them, dazed creatures thrashing a foreign element, defenseless babes, carp in a well, easily caught, easily speared, easily killed. And I'm going to finish up with a poem called The Ravine. The Ravine. Plasticity, they call this quality of the brain, the ability to reorganize neural pathways. If associations can be made, they can be broken. What is delusion but persistent belief in the faith, What is delusion but persistent belief in the face of overwhelming agreement to the contrary? Mirror, mirror on the wall is a strategy. Self-perception equals hypothermic waters in a world where ideas have the status of facts. Money, family, country, and race, all are ideas consecrated as fact. I picture Sunday Mass, the priest holding up before us the magnum-sized host, the chalice of mini hosts, and then the golden cup filled with wine. I hear each time the sonorous bong the mushroom-shaped bell makes when hit with the leather-topped stick. I remember the feeling of the slim white communion host dissolving on my tongue, its stale taste. How strange if transubstantiation had really taken place. The wine thickening and tasting like pennies, the host swelling into soft, rubbery flesh. It's impossible, of course, but what is possible, infinitely realizable, is the human capacity to behave as though sweet sherry were blood and a dry wafer a sliver of parchment. What is really real? Know them by their fruits, I hear my old parish priest say. He would agree that how we apprehend the world is largely illusion. It's possible to be afraid of chocolate. Once I was so thin I could encircle my clavicle with my thumb and my index finger. The mentally ill sometimes see themselves as visionaries. Many of the saints were probably mad, and many of the scientists too, perhaps. Despair turns into a cramp in my colon. Hope at such moments is in being irrational. If how we see the world is largely imagined, can we not break and remake associations, reorder? Putting one foot in front of the other, I start a list. Strong as a hare, swift as an ox, sly as a bee, quiet as a dodo, busy as a fox, hungry as an eel, dead as a peacock, weak as a badger, slow as a lamb. In this way, I make progress along the ravine, my boots crunching thin layers of ice. Thank you very much for listening.